This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 4th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, the Senate debates Judge Sotomayor's nomination as Supreme Court Justice. Free speech advocates protest the shutdown of 34 radio stations in Venezuela and laws that would imprison journalists who commit media crimes. And we go to Nicaragua, where human rights groups are calling on the government to revoke a universal ban on abortion.
Due to criminalization of abortion, a 19-year-old woman went to the hospital in bad shape after provoking an abortion and was not treated due to the doctor's fear of prosecution.
All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Taliban claimed responsibility for firing 8 rockets early today into the heart of Kabul. 2 of them landed in a residential area near the American embassy. Asma Namadi reports.
3 civilians were wounded in this morning's rocket attack on the heart of Kabul. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the 8 rockets fired, announcing that the attacks were to show the government's inability to secure the capital before upcoming elections. Rocket attacks are uncommon in Kabul, but they have reached military posts and Western embassy compounds in the past. In another attack in the western city of Herat, 12 people were killed by a roadside bomb yesterday. The Taliban also claimed responsibility for yesterday's attack. Among the killed were a woman, a 12-year-old girl, and 2 policemen. A district police chief was also seriously wounded in Monday's blast in Herat. As a recent UN report highlighted a 24% rise in civilian deaths from the same period as 2008, the Taliban have promised further disorder in advance of Afghan elections scheduled for August 20th. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Asma Namadi reporting from Kabul.
A group of human rights experts have expressed concern at the trend towards extensive privatization of the war in Afghanistan. UN Radio's Basira Kostov.
The Human Rights Council Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries concluded an official 2-week visit to the United States on the 3rd of August. The leader of the group delegation, Ms. Shaista Shamim, said its members are particularly alarmed that the use of private military and security companies to protect U.S. forward operating bases in most places in Afghanistan may further dilute the distinction between military and civilian personnel, an obligation under international humanitarian law. Following the Nisour Square killings of 16th of September 2007 in Baghdad, where Blackwater guards shot 17 Iraqi civilians, the U.S. Congress repeatedly expressed its concern at the lack of proper oversight of private military and security contractors. The working group noted that the U.S. government has since taken serious corrective action, including adoption of legislation and regulations aimed at strengthening the oversight and accountability of private contractors for security functions. For UN Radio, I'm Bisera Kostova.
According to federal court documents obtained by author Jeremy Scahill and published in The Nation magazine, 2 former employees of the military contractor Blackwater, now called Z, have suggested company owner Eric Prince may have either killed or arranged to kill people that aided federal investigations of the company. In sworn statements filed under threat of perjury, the former workers also claim that Prince moved illegal or unlawful weapons into Iraq and that he and other Blackwater administrators intentionally destroyed evidence. One worker also says Prince, quote, views himself as a Christian crusader tasked with eliminating Muslims and the Islamic faith from the globe and, quote, encouraged and rewarded the destruction of Iraqi life. The statements were filed late last night as part of a motion on behalf of Iraqi civilians suing Blackwater for alleged war crimes. North Korean media reports that leader Kim Jong-il has pardoned the 2 reporters who had been sentenced to 12 years of hard labor and ordered their release. The 2 had been accused of illegal entry and hostile acts. This after former U.S. President Bill Clinton met today with the North Korean leader in Pyongyang during an unannounced and highly unusual visit. According to North Korea, the 2 held exhaustive talks on a variety of matters. The White House characterizes the trip as a private mission, and the State Department refused to comment on the trip at all. In Iran today, the governor of Kurdistan province confirmed that 3 Americans, including 1 journalist, have been arrested there and charged with illegal entry. Shane Bauer reports for New American Media. Bauer, along with Sarah Short and Joshua Fatal, was detained Friday after allegedly crossing an unmarked border between Iraq and Iran. As the United States has no diplomatic relationship with Iran, Swiss officials are working to establish contact with the detained Americans. Also today, Iranian authorities said they would prosecute security personnel and judicial officials accused of abusing civilians following the general elections held in June. Iran's opposition has called for more street demonstrations tomorrow to protest the second-term inauguration of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. In a new report issued today, Human Rights Watch has accused police in India of widespread rights violations. Free Speech Radio News' Bismillah Gilani has more.
The report titled Broken System, Dysfunction, Abuse and Impunity in the Indian Police was released today in the southern Indian city of Bangalore. Documenting various incidents of rights abuses like arbitrary detentions, torture and custodial killings, it says the police have scant regard for the legal procedures and are often a law unto themselves. The US-based group says it took them 1 year to compile the report based on interviews with police officers, victims of police excesses, experts and activists. The group says many of the police officers interviewed confessed to committing abuse during investigations in order to win accolades from their seniors. Besides detailing the abuses, the report also speaks of challenges faced by the police, such as lack of sufficient resources, inadequate training, and poor living conditions. Further, it urges the government to take immediate steps to overhaul what it calls a failing system that encourages abuses. The Indian authorities have not yet reacted to the report. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor has passed several hurdles on her way to the High Court. She now awaits her confirmation by the U.S. Senate, which will go on recess this Friday. The debate on Sotomayor's confirmation began on the Senate floor today. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
Amidst a busy legislative schedule in the final 3 days of their summer work session, the Senate began debate Tuesday on the confirmation of Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. The debate will be squeezed into the Senate's crowded docket alongside votes on a tourism bill and a $2 billion extension of the popular Cash for Clunkers auto trade-in program. Though confirmation of Sotomayor looks inevitable, Republican support for the nominee is low. In his opening comments, Majority Leader Harry Reid expressed his disappointment in the partisan split over the nominee's confirmation.
Many senators have very thoughtfully said that they regret how politicized the process of confirming judges has become in recent years. I am disappointed not more of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are likely to vote for this outstanding nominee, particularly in light of her record and qualifications. But maybe in the future, things will get better.
A handful of Republican senators are expected to vote yes for Sotomayor's confirmation this week, but most are solidly opposed. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell voiced his party's concerns in his opening remarks on Tuesday.
The primary reason I will not support this nomination, as I have already said, is because I cannot support the so-called empathy standard upon which Judge Sotomayor was selected and to which she herself has subscribed in her writings and rulings.
Only six Republicans are expected to support Sotomayor's confirmation. Some senators say they fear a situation similar to the bitter partisan disputes over court nominations during the Bush administration, when Democrats tried to block several Republican nominees to federal courts. In 2006, then-Senator Obama was part of a failed filibuster of the Alito nomination. This time, Republicans show no signs of attempting a filibuster, which would surely be defeated by the Democratic majority. But partisan lines have been clearly drawn. One Republican who is crossing the aisle to back Sotomayor is Mel Martinez from Florida. He says this week's debate is a chance to focus on legislative principle rather than political divides.
Well, I think it's very important for me to make the point that we need to get nominations, confirmation hearings and confirmation in the Senate back to what it used to be, back to something that focuses on qualifications, experience, judicial temperament, the kinds of things that qualify someone to be on the bench, not an ideological battle that disqualifies people merely because someone fears that perhaps at some point they might be an activist. I just don't think that's good enough.
But politics are a factor in the confirmation. Senator Martinez says his fellow Republicans who are voting against Sotomayor may be at risk to lose certain voters.
My colleagues are not acting in their best political interest, it's clear to me, with the Hispanic minority in this country by the attitude they're taking. So I hope that there's well-founded and well, you know, held beliefs that are not really political.
Lisa Navarrete, Vice President of the National Council of La Raza, says overwhelming pride and support for Sotomayor among Latinos makes this confirmation vote politically important for senators looking to woo Hispanics in future elections.
Any issue that comes before the Senate or the House of Representatives inevitably has political implications. What we're not saying is that we're doubting the concerns that senators may have with regard to her ideology or her record on the court, but we know that the Supreme Court is an issue in every election. That does come up, and again, that the fact that a senator may have voted against this nomination, what effect that will have with his or her Latino constituents, I think, is something to consider, and I think time will tell what effect it will have.
The senators will continue to debate on Wednesday, with a final vote on the Senate floor likely to happen on Thursday, the final day before recess. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
On Capitol Hill, financial agencies are opposing a plan by the Obama administration to restructure the bank and regulatory system. At a hearing in the Senate today, the heads of the FDIC, the Office of Thrift Supervision, and the Comptroller of the Currency gave the plan an enthusiastic thumbs down. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
The Obama administration wants to create a Financial Services Oversight Council to identify systemic risks in financial markets. It also wants to create a consumer protection agency to safeguard consumers against deceptive banking practices. The proposal would establish a new national banking supervisor that would regulate federally chartered banks. It would also give the FDIC and the Federal Reserve regulation of state banks. And it would give the Federal Reserve increased power to regulate financial firms that pose a risk to the economy. Last month, President Obama acknowledged that his plan wouldn't be popular with all.
There are also those who say that we are going too far. But the events of the past few years offer ample testimony for the need to make significant changes. The absence of a working regulatory regime over many parts of the financial system and over the system as a whole led us to near catastrophe. We shouldn't forget that.
Many federal regulators oppose the plan. At Tuesday's hearing, FDIC Chair Sheila Bair said more regulation is exactly what isn't needed.
We do not see merit or wisdom in consolidating all federal banking supervision. The risk of weak or misdirected regulation would be exacerbated by a single federal regulator that embarked on a wrong policy course. Prudent risk management argues strongly against putting all your regulatory and supervisory eggs in one basket. One of the advantages of multiple regulators is that it permits diverse viewpoints to be heard.
Bair said a more unified regulatory approach would cause the government to focus on the biggest financial firms.
In turn, this could cause more consolidation in the banking industry at a time when efforts are underway to reduce systemic exposure to very large financial institutions and to end too big to fail. Concentrating examination authority in a single regulator also could hurt bank deposit insurance. The loss of an ongoing and significant supervisory role would greatly diminish the effectiveness of the FDIC's ability to perform a congressional mandate.
The Obama administration plan would create a new national bank supervisor by combining the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the agency that charters and regulates national banks, with the Office of Thrift Supervision, the agency that charters and regulates federal thrifts. John Bowman, acting director of the Office of Thrift Supervision, says this step is not necessary.
We don't see any reason to cause major disruptions for the hundreds of legitimate, well-run financial businesses that are operating successfully with the thrift charter and making credit available to American consumers.
Committee member Senator Charles Schumer, however, accused the regulators of just trying to protect their own turf.
If I were sitting where you were with hardworking men and women working for you, I'd say, keep my agency, keep all the powers, don't do any consolidation. I think we in the committee have to see the testimony as coming from at least partially that perspective.
Schumer said there are other reasons for new forms of regulation. For example, to increase accountability.
A hodgepodge of different regulators adds to conflicts in regulation and creates confusing burdens for the banks. We've all heard from institutions who were told one thing by one regulator and another thing by another regulator, each of whom has authority.
The committee will be holding another hearing to gather feedback from those in the banking community who want more reform. Secretary of the Treasury Tim Geithner has spoken out against regulators that have not agreed with the administration's plan. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Kenya today, along with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack and U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk. The U.S. officials are discussing trade and development, as well as hunger and agriculture. Clinton's also expected to meet with the president of Somalia's transitional federal government. Sheikh Sharif Ahmed is in Nairobi this week for a conference on African trade and cooperation. He welcomed the meeting with Secretary Clinton, saying the world is giving attention to Somalia and giving it much-needed help. Human rights groups say they want Clinton to address one of the biggest issues facing both Somalia and Kenya, the Dadaab refugee camp in northeastern Kenya. More than 300,000 Somalians displaced by decades of fighting in their own country live in Dadaab, which aid workers say is the world's largest refugee camp. Today, the United Nations said its resources are stretched too thin, and refugees are lacking access to basic needs like water and sanitation. Yusuf Hassan is a press officer with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Hassan said the Dadaab camp was built to host up to 90,000 refugees.
But now it has nearly 300,000, which is several times the capacity of the camp in handling the needs of refugees in terms of water, in terms of sanitation, in terms of health. And so there's a lot of pressure on all of these facilities that the camp facilities can simply not cope with. In addition, we also have a shortage of water because there's not enough space. The refugees who are there are crammed on a declining or decreasing space as more and more people come from Somalia. And at the moment, the camp receives up to 5,000 people every month.
Refugees International wants Clinton to pressure Kenya into providing more land for the refugees. Thousands of other Somalians are trying to flee from the other side of the country. According to the UN, some 12,000 Somalis are now in the northern port city of Bosaso, waiting for smugglers to take them across the Gulf of Aden to Yemen. In Venezuela, a group of supporters of President Chavez attacked a television station that's highly critical of the Venezuelan government. Using clubs and tear gas, more than 20 members of the Venezuelan Popular Union forced their way into the Caracas headquarters of Globovisión Monday. Some threatened TV staff with guns, and one policewoman was injured. The Venezuelan government condemned the incident, calling on its supporters to wage their politics through peaceful means. But Globovisión President Guillermo Zuluaga blamed the government for the attack.
They're not only attacking us in the courts or at the National Communications Commission. Now these armed groups supported by the government come here to attack us with tear gas.
The physical attack on media follows a number of moves that many say are restricting freedom of the press. On Monday, the Venezuelan government revoked the licenses of 34 radio stations, claiming they had failed to comply with administrative procedures related to their licenses. Many of these stations were critical of the government's policies, and opposition groups have called the move an assault against free speech. Last week, the Venezuelan government drafted a law on media crimes that would set prison terms for journalists whose stories, quote, harm the interest of the state, cause panic, or disturb social peace. The United Nations and several prominent human rights groups have expressed their concerns about this law, with Human Rights Watch calling it a recipe for censure. To learn more about this issue and the challenges faced by the media in Venezuela and other countries, we spoke to Ernest Sagaga from the International Federation of Journalists. The IFJ represents the interests of some 600,000 journalists around the world, and Sagaga is their communications and human rights officer. We spoke with him about the shutdown of the Venezuelan radio stations earlier today.
That is something which is of major concern for us. It is cutting off important information space to opposition, but also to other critics who may be politicians or otherwise, in running of the state of Venezuela.
The government says the licenses were taken away for administrative reasons because the stations failed to file some paperwork. Do you think it was a balanced measure, or were certain stations targeted?
Any media organization must be indeed in conformity with the law of the land, but you don't need to revoke a license because a paper is not order. What you do, you ask for that particular documentation to be submitted, but the station can continue broadcasting. These stations are not new. They have been broadcasting for a while, and there should be no reason why they should lose their license if they can submit whatever paperwork is needed while carrying out the activities as usual.
The government says the licenses will be given to community radio stations because the idea is to make the media more democratic. What do you think of that measure?
It's not for the government to say which radio should be created or not. Media exist in order to inform the public. And journalists are free to set up media organizations, and it's not for the government to say which one should be allowed to operate and which one should not. You may have both. We don't say that there shouldn't be community radios, but what we say is that one should not exclude the other.
Could you tell us about this law against media crimes? How would that affect freedom of expression?
As we understand, it's a new law which is going to punish what they call media crimes, meaning something like causing panic, harming the interests of the state. These are loosely defined offenses, and we fear that they will give room for maneuver for those who want to repress press freedom. And we believe that in that our position, media offenses should never be criminalized. That should be something that can be taken to media organization, self-regulatory bodies, staffed by journalists who know their job, who know their profession, and who are best able to handle any kind of concern that may arise.
What about the nationalization of media? We read this morning that President Rafael Correa in Ecuador said he plans to nationalize some private media. Is this happening in other countries around the world?
As you know, we're going through a global economic crisis. And that means there will be an issue from time to time, from one country to another, an issue of who should be investing in the media as a public good, as a public service. Now, in that regard, there is nothing preventing a government to invest in the media. That investment, as welcome as it may be, should not be for the purpose of controlling or manipulating the media. It should be only for the purpose of helping the media cope with the crisis, continue to inform the public, and contribute to democracy in a country.
That was Ernest Sagaga from the International Federation of Journalists speaking to FSRN about the threats to media freedom in Venezuela and around the world. Amnesty International is calling on the Nicaraguan government to overturn a section of the penal code that punishes abortions with prison sentences for both the patient and the provider. The law provides for no exceptions, even when a pregnant woman's health and her welfare are at risk. The legality of the abortion ban has now become a matter for the Nicaraguan Supreme Court. Nan McCurdy reports from Managua.
For over 100 years, Nicaraguan women had the legal right to a therapeutic abortion when their health was in danger. But in November 2006, the National Assembly changed the law, and then President Bolaños made any kind of abortion illegal, even in cases of rape or incest. Then in 2007, the Nicaraguan legislators passed a new penal code that included the abortion ban, signed into law in July 2008 by current President Daniel Ortega. Dr. Ana Evelyn Orozco is a leader of the September 28th campaign for the decriminalization of abortion in Latin America and the Caribbean, one of the many organizations that has challenged the constitutionality of the abortion ban.
The importance of the decision about decriminalization of abortion in Nicaragua is really about defending the right of women to decide, to decide about their life, about their body, about their family. The right to decide is vital. The first death due to criminalization of abortion was a 19-year-old woman who went to the hospital in bad shape after provoking an abortion and was not treated due to the doctor's fear of prosecution. This young woman died, leaving her other child orphaned. These are avoidable deaths.
According to Dr. Orozco, 94 women have died since 2006 as a result of the abortion ban, and the government often does not report the deaths as such. If a young woman commits suicide because she can't get an abortion or dies in the process of trying to abort, the death is recorded as a suicide rather than as a consequence of not being able to get a safe abortion. But some say the law has made women safer. Dr. Rafael Cabrera is president of the Nicaraguan Association for Life.
Statistics in Nicaragua show that since passing the law criminalizing abortion, maternal deaths had gone down 30%, just like in Chile, El Salvador, Ireland, and Poland.
Dr. Cabrera says the movement of Christians against abortion in Latin America is growing. Along with anti-abortion legislation, Chile, El Salvador, and Honduras passed laws protecting the life of the unborn child. But the laws in Nicaragua are so strict that human rights groups are trying to overturn them. On May 28, 2009, the United Nations declared that Nicaragua's abortion ban violates the country's obligations under the Convention Against Torture. And for the first time, 13 international experts and organizations, like the U.S.-based Center for Reproductive Rights, have submitted Friend of the Court briefs to the Nicaraguan Supreme Court in support of local groups challenging the complete ban on abortion. One of those groups is CINID, the Nicaraguan Center for Human Rights, the first organization to introduce a motion of unconstitutionality in 2006. Since then, 75 similar motions have been presented to the court. Dr. Wendy Flores, a lawyer for CINID, worked with the UN on this Nicaraguan human rights issue.
The United Nations has recommended that Nicaragua should adjust its legislation to prevent deaths of women from illegal, unsafe, and clandestine abortions, and in the case of rape, incest, or congenital malformations. Like the situation of a woman who works in the sweatshops, who knew that her fetus lacked part of the brain and would not live. She was forced to carry the fetus to term. The baby was born, died, and she had to bury it. She was left with serious psychological problems.
Many organizations allege deal-making between the Catholic Church and the two major parties, the Sandinistas and the Liberals, leading up to the presidential elections of 2006. Supreme Court Justice Rafael Solis, Sandinista, told FSRN about the pressures that led to the abortion ban.
I believe the national campaign mounted by the Catholic Church, the marches they had, the signatures they collected, the appearance they gave that more than 1 million people were against therapeutic abortion, had its impact and had this effect on Sandinista and liberal legislators. But now in the court, we want to put that aside to look at the subject with objectivity and impartiality beyond the political criteria that could have affected the Congress.
Justice Solis said the court will decide on the constitutionality of the abortion ban in July. Nan McCurdy, FSRN, Managua.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.